Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, in a housing market defined by soaring rents and an increase in foreclosures, we speak to two legal experts about how to anticipate and avoid a personal housing crisis. Later in the program, a Black podcaster talks about food equality and the joys of getting your hands dirty. But first, finding an affordable place to live is sometimes half the battle. A range of pitfalls can send people on a path to foreclosure or even eviction, but there are strategies to help, and to talk about them and the legal help that is available to people, I'm joined by Kevin Rabin, litigation director for Three Rivers Legal Services. Hey, Kevin.
Hi, great to be on.
And Casey Wagner, president of the agency's board of director. Directors. Hey, Casey.
Hi.
So, Kevin, you provide free or reduced legal help to people facing all kinds of housing issues. What are some of the top challenges that you see happening today?
In terms of our housing cases, I think the most challenging thing for our clients and everyone that contacts us is just simply unaffordable housing. It's a really hard time out there for most of our clients to afford rent, increased home ownership costs, whether that be just mortgage costs, the cost of, you know, interest on every new mortgage originated in the last few years, or just the home insurance crisis and the increase in property taxes that many people across our area are experiencing.
Do you see issues affecting homeowners or renters more frequently?
Renters much more frequently. Our client base, is a wide range of low-income Floridians in North Central Florida. So homeowners are a little bit less of the clients that we see, but we've seen a marked increase in home ownership problems over the last year or so, at the same time that we've seen the rental housing crisis begin to ebb to a small degree.
So some of this started during the financial crisis, Casey, and it's, continued since then. Explain to us why the roots of some of what we're seeing today in the housing market, and particularly Florida's housing market, date that far back.
Well, I think that you've got the perfect storm, and you've got rising interest rates and decrease in supply. And also, one thing that we're seeing more and more is that people are holding on to their homes much longer. So you're not seeing the aging out of the family home that you used to see, maybe 30 years ago. So older folks are staying in their homes longer, and then up-and-comer starter home folks don't have any homes to buy. So that's one issue. And then you also have the takeover, basically, of the rental housing market by investors. So you no longer have where a majority of people who are renting out homes, the majority of landlords are individuals or families who have invested in a second property, or maybe that was their starter home. And then when they moved up to a bigger home, they're renting it out. That used to be the normal model for renting. But in 08 and since, you've seen a much more investment in private equity into the rental market. So now you have these big private corporations who are made up of investors from all over really the world. And those are people who are making decisions about how much the rent is, whether or not somebody can be a week late on their payment and things like that.
So how did we get to that point, Kevin? How did we get to the point that so many properties have been purchased by large, conglomerates as opposed to individuals?
I think the easiest way to kind of visualize it is remembering back in the financial crisis, just how many homeowners went into foreclosure, especially in Florida. We were the vanguard of the foreclosure crisis. So many homes that were underwater. What happened to a lot of those homes after the foreclosure occurred is they sat what we call real estate owned properties, right? Owned by the banks that had lent the money because they couldn't sell them. They were, these incredibly over leveraged debt properties. What eventually happened is they began liquidating those, and they sold them for, in many cases, pennies on the dollar, or the investments on them for pennies on the dollar to institutional investors who were happy to just gobble up what they considered a relatively cheap deal. And as we hit the pandemic, interest rates bottomed out. Those investors could get a lot more cash flow in to acquire a lot of those properties at the same time that real estate prices started to skyrocket. And you see pretty quickly what happens. These investors were able to gobble up this portfolio of single-family homes, especially in communities like Jacksonville, And now that they are the owners, they're able to capitalize on that market, whether now selling them for incredible profit or, as we've seen much more frequently, renting them at a higher value proposition than they would have certainly 10, 15 years ago.
You know, you talk about homes being sold pennies on the dollar to the interests that owned them. Was there ever any opportunity for people who were being forced out of those homes, who were being foreclosed on, to acquire those homes at that kind of a rate as opposed to, you know, what they originally paid for the house?
Absolutely not. That's one of the biggest, you know, difficulties of how we solved the housing crisis in large part was trying to prevent the same actors who lent these, you know, massive loans relatively irresponsibly. They were the ones that got the financial assistance to prevent the complete fallout of the economy. The homeowners weren't given that. And as a result, many of them exited home ownership, entered the rental market. And for a time, you know, rental prices were affordable, right? Because, you know, interest was relatively low. There was a lot of caution in the market and an available supply. But at the same time, then you stop seeing new builds, right? There was a constraint because, you know, at least then a lot of caution about what to do with money in the market. And that just led to fewer and fewer opportunities, especially once this boom really hit in earnest. And I think it really started in 2019, but the pandemic accelerated it once the interest rates dropped in that, you know, 3-month interval, right when kind of everything shut down.
So let's talk about the pandemic, because that really did throw back some of the progress that had been made in terms of stabilizing the housing market. Casey, so what impact did that have in terms of destabilizing homes for renters or for homeowners?
Well, it was a double whammy. The pandemic really just put gas on the fire of what was already stewing from 08. And what you're facing then is tons of people from all over the country coming to Jacksonville. I mean, it's a very specific problem here. We had an increase in population of, 100,000 people in the last couple of years. So you've got people choosing to live here who are willing to pay way over market value for homes because they're on budgets as if they live in Brooklyn. And so they're taking their housing allowance or their budget that they had in New York and they're relocating to Jacksonville. They're able to scoop up properties at whatever price anybody's willing to sell them for. So that's the home ownership side. You're seeing people.
And that's like a factor of remote work that people are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then on the rental side, all of those people, like Kevin was saying, they don't have anywhere to go. And so we had a huge influx of people who needed rental property. And so supply, demand, you know, the demand is going up, supply is going down, prices are skyrocketing in the rental market as well.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about avoiding financial crisis in your own home and your own apartment living. We're talking with two legal experts about opportunities available to forestall some of those crises. And you can join us on air if you call 904-549-2937, and you can email your questions to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out to us on social media. In terms of the pandemic impact, Kevin, the what Casey's alluding to is, you know, this shift to a different kind of acquisition, you know, different base of income to get the property. Is there any way, I mean, given the history of housing bubbles and real estate busts in Florida, is there any way to kind of accurately ascertain what properties are worth, what values should be? Because I mean, I saw a statistic that after 2000, that home prices increased like 96% between 2000 and 2007 in Florida. Just an extraordinary, you know, acceleration.
And it kind of feels like we're seeing a similar bubble forming at this point. It's hard because, you know, again, looking at the macro level, right, the whole national economy and how housing prices got to the point they're at, it's really hard to say if this is going to be abating anytime soon. I mean, you know, I would have expected, as we started to see kind of a cool down in the rental pricing that we started to see at the end of last year into now. Again, it's not like the rents are dropping. They're just not rising as quickly as they were. I would have expected to see something similar in the home market, but that hasn't happened. You know, especially I live in Gainesville. Gainesville's housing prices have increased by a factor of about 70% since 2019. And that's, you know, again, you're talking a college town with a population of about 130,000 people. So it's become this bigger conversation, I think, throughout North Central Florida. We've seen it in some of the rural communities we serve, too. Even Lake City and some of the rural communities near Live Oak, even in Dixie County, you're seeing these increases, even, you know, again, in relative scale, that I'm just not sure are going to slow down anytime soon because the demand is here. People are relocating to the state of Florida. You know, again, we're not the only ones. Texas, I think, has a very similar story to tell at just astronomical rates.
How is the impact of insurance rate increases playing into this issue? I know that a lot of people have been experiencing, you know, really big jumps in escrow payments because their mortgage, you know, their mortgage payments are going up because of their insurance rates. You know, in Florida, in some eyes of some people, is becoming uninsurable.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And it again is an accelerator of the same problems that we're talking about, because there's only a certain segment of the homeownership market that can afford those increased insurance rates. And so I think as if we don't do something legislatively to control the insurance problems, and I don't think that what was done in the last session was enough. I think there's got to be more that's done. You're going to continue to see the privatization of homeownership and then renting back to families who used to be homeowners. And there are people moving out of the state. I mean, it's kind of a weird dichotomy. We've got people coming in at record numbers, but then statewide, we are seeing some people selling and getting out because they can't afford the new prices with the insurance.
And there is kind of this shift to whole communities of single family homes that are rental communities. Talk a little bit about that trend.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, you're seeing statewide that neighborhoods that, you know, used to be where they clear the field and build a bunch of homes that all kind of match and the kind of cookie cutter neighborhoods, those used to be starter homes for families with one or two children. And now those whole communities are going in the direction of being, you know, owned by an investment group and rented back to those same families that used to be homeowners.
And explain to us why that option is not just available, but in some cases unavoidable for families, Kevin.
So, yeah, I mean, when you look at the total number of new constructions, you know, most of the starter homes that are being built are in many ways more expensive than they would have been a generation ago, right? You know, your typical starter home, you know, back in the 1970s probably would have been a 2-bedroom, 1-bathroom home. Now the standard is 3.2. The square footage is about 1,500 square feet or larger. And all of the material costs, labor costs, you know, permitting costs that go into that are going to be higher. And the profit margins for most developers and builders are going to be higher. That's what they're targeting. And that's where the development is. So, you know, for a lot of, you know, first-time home buyers, especially with the current interest rates, they're just not going to be able to access that. The average mortgage that they'd be looking at would be somewhere between $300,000 to $400,000, you know, with an interest rate that's going to cost them a ton over time. And, you know, for the institutional investors, many of whom gobbled up these opportunities during the pandemic, they look at that and they say, we can make a lot more just renting to those same families at $2,000, $2,200 a month. And we know there's going to be a consistent supply. So that's going to be a much more lucrative investment than trying to work with this developer to then offload the properties and, you know, maybe try to use, you know, covenants or HOAs as a way to recoup some of that long-term tail.
The intensity of storms, the frequency of storms, and, you know, the peril that we have, particularly in Florida, to climate change is, you know, becoming a reality, something that the insurance market is starting to grapple with and homeowners are really starting to recognize, Casey. But is that going to fundamentally change the equation in homeownership just as it becomes less and less affordable to pay for insurance, or as it becomes harder to get, you know, financing for a house because of the cost of insurance?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you also have to look at the geographical location of the neighborhoods where people who can't afford that higher insurance are going to end up being concentrated. Typically, those are going to be neighborhoods that are affected more by the changing climate. So lower lying, more prone to flooding, or, you know, areas with less trees and more prone to wind damage. So when you take into account that that folks of less means are going to be concentrated in areas affected by climate change, it really does create a bigger problem. And then, you know, I'll mention something that Kevin and I have discussed previously, which is we're also losing the safety net of the mobile home neighborhoods in Florida, because those are now becoming more dangerous of a place to live, but also more difficult to own. I think Kevin can speak to that more than me even.
Yeah. I mean, the model also for a mobile home has changed in terms of, you know, it's what it looks like, the amenities it offers. So it is a different model than it was 30 years ago.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Florida has, you know, was one of the first states to really embrace the mobile home park model, where homeowners would purchase mobile homes, rent the lots within a park, and, you know, cohabitate in a larger community. You know, there's been a lot of, you know, historical issues with that. But ultimately, what we started to see during the pandemic was this new accelerant of acquisition of mobile home parks by these same private equity investment firms that were purchasing for $2, $3 million and immediately pricing out all of the families who lived in this kind of naturally occurring form of affordable housing. Again, and you know, you consider also the increase in insurance costs, and you start to see this perfect storm that is decimating mobile home park ownership and converting it into a much more lucrative form of mobile home park rent, where the mobile homes are not owned by individual homeowners any longer, but are owned by the park itself and are rented at relatively similar rates that you would see single family home rentals. And we've definitely noticed across, you know, North Central Florida that that has been a huge, very quiet method of displacement of existing homeowners.
And what happens to people who are being displaced? I mean, we talk about mobile homes, but in many cases, these things have been parked for years and years, and they really aren't mobile. They certainly aren't street worthy.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the cost to move even a relatively newly purchased or newly built mobile home is going to cost between $8,000 to $15,000 to begin with. So, you know, whether the mobile home can even be moved is a question. The cost is substantial. And for many of the low-income homeowners who live in parks, it's just unaffordable per se. Beyond that, you know, the parks aren't being required to pay for this acquisition if the park is basically forcing these folks out through rent increases or through non-renewals or other forms, some of which are legal, some of which are not. But you've seen a lot of efforts to displace the homeowners, and, you know, they in many ways lose the home in the process. Sometimes, you know, if they're lucky, if the park is just closing, they can try to apply for some funding through the state of Florida's relocation fund. But in my experience, helping clients in those cases, it's been rare to get that funding. And when they've gotten it, it's been insufficient to actually assist them as far as they would need it to.
And so in some cases, these people are leaving behind the homes that they own, and the landlord is inheriting them, able to renovate them, rent them out again, because these people have been priced out by increasing rents.
Exactly. And then they're forced to go look for something else that will work.
We have a email from Jim in Riverside. He said, can you please ask your guests about the specific work they do to help renters facing evictions and how they are funded?
Certainly. So, you know, we are funded by a number of different sources at the organization I work for, Three Rivers Legal Services. Our primary funding comes from the federal government, and it requires that we serve a certain concentration of low-income households that fall below a certain income level. That income level gets very technical, but it's generally designed to help us focus on the most needy and most at-risk populations that are at risk of eviction, domestic violence, and other issues that we serve them with. We take a lot of eviction cases for full representation. We defend them in court. A lot of times we'll file counterclaims or affirmative suits against landlords for malfeasance that they commit. And, you know, we try to serve clients with any number of issues, including some systemic ones when we come across them.
Like?
Mobile home parks are a pretty common one. We have sometimes seen, as I mentioned before, illegal rent increases. Mobile home parks are one of the few places in rental housing where there is actually a statutory requirement of how rent increases are to occur. There is a cap of sorts that exists. And we've seen parks disregard that, especially from equity investors who aren't familiar with Florida's legislative requirements. We've also seen what I'll call fake park closures, where they'll allege that they're closing the park. They're not closing the park. They're just trying to force the existing homeowners out in order to bring in new, more lucrative, you know, new construction mobile homes that they'll rent out instead.
And you talk about a cap for increases in mobile home parks, but there is no such cap in rent, generally speaking. Is that right?
Yes. And this is something that a lot of private tenants who live in single family homes, apartments, duplexes, condominiums will contact us about and say, I thought that there was some state law that said they can only increase my rent by so much. Outside of some very rare federally subsidized housing programs, that's not the case. And as much as I wish there was at least some measure of trying to provide a cap, state law doesn't provide for one. And given an act in the legislative session a little over a year ago, no local municipality can try to enact a cap themselves either.
You know, Jim in his email had asked about the work that you do on evictions. How effective is litigating an eviction?
So, I mean, when you get involved, and I think this is the hard thing, is most evictions, I think broadly, are resolved without attorneys representing a tenant. That's just 90% or more. A tenant will never have representation. And most of those cases are going to be won by the landlord, some by default because the tenant doesn't file a response, doesn't deposit rent to the court registry, which is one of the requirements in cases. But when we get involved in cases where we see good legal issues to assist clients, our success rate is very substantial. And it comes in several forms. You know, sometimes we'll win the eviction case outright, preventing any displacement of the home residents, or you know, anyone in their family. Other times, we are going to end up brokering some agreement with the landlord, one that maybe should have been suggested by the landlord to start with, but usually, and I would say the vast majority of our cases, are going to resolve with some resolution, some settlement between the parties that puts them in a position that improves both of their interests. Maybe sometimes the tenant will have to move. They'll get time. They may get some rent relief. They may, you know, get some relief from other charges that were illegally imposed. And in some cases, you know, again, I don't like to say that we're perfect. We will lose some eviction cases. That's just the nature of legal practice. But in those cases, too, we always see a benefit from the household at least getting the opportunity to assert themselves in court with a lawyer, and certainly buying more time for them to make plans to relocate.
Casey, you talked about, you know, legislative help, you know, for instance, on the insurance front. What other legislative, you know, options are there that are being bandied about or that you all are pressing for in Tallahassee?
I think probably the biggest thing for legal aid in Florida is we are the only state in the entire country that receives no funding from the state of Florida. Florida does not support legal aid. And so every legal aid organization in the state of Florida is funded through grants, through the federal government, through private donors. And I think that one thing, if there could be some piece of the tax pie, of the tax revenue pie that could go to legal aid, that would change these organizations massively. That's systemic versus like getting into particular issues.
Has that always been that way, or is that a recent development?
That has always been that way. Yeah, Florida just does not prioritize legal aid. It's really sad.
How about from your perspective, are there legislative initiatives that you think would be beneficial in terms of preventing some of these, you know, problems from blossoming into a full-blown crisis?
I mean, I think what's regrettable is that we saw municipalities in the wake of the pandemic taking their own steps to address local issues of concern and trying to maybe tailor the response of what was needed. Like, for example, increased notice periods before a tenant could be evicted. Some communities had said you need 30 days notice for, you know, a non-renewal of tenancy. And the legislature, as it has been wont to do over recent years, opted to preempt that authority of municipal governments to try to provide that backbone of support. And it was regrettable because, you know, the needs of every county, the needs of every city are going to be a little different. Every housing, you know, community is particular. And that was really regrettable. And I would hope to see the legislature consider maybe giving back that specific home rule power, giving back that control for, you know, say the city of Jacksonville to address its specific issues the way that the residents of the community want to do it. Because, you know, again, a one size fits all approach from Tallahassee really does not work, especially given the diversity within the regions of the state of Florida.
You know, you're talking about investment properties at the large scale where, you know, large companies are buying, acquiring huge parcels, you know, tracts of land with homes on them. But the model for what a home is, what it signifies to individuals, has also changed somewhat in terms of being viewed more or at least equally like an investment as opposed to just a place to live. How does that weigh into this whole equation?
Well, you know, as you asked me that, it makes me think about one thing we haven't discussed yet, which is the vacation rental situation. So a lot of people might buy a home to live in at the beginning. And then, you know, what I talked about earlier, the model 30 years ago would have been when you grow your family and move into the slightly bigger home, maybe you rent out that starter home or you sell it. Now you're seeing that as a money-making opportunity. You're going to stick it on VRBO. I mean, we live in an area where vacation renting is prevalent. And, you know, there's areas, some towns are dealing with that through like St. Augustine, who I think has done a very good job, where there's a license attached to the parcel and they've capped the number of licenses. And so you can, when you purchase a home, if it's already an Airbnb, you can continue it, but there aren't any new ones being added to the stock. Jack's Beach, Atlantic Beach, Neptune Beach are not doing that. And so that's another situation where you're using the home for a purpose it was never really meant for. Now all of a sudden it's a hotel condo type situation. And that, again, is just pushing more and more people into a tighter and tighter rental market.
Does viewing your home as an asset as opposed to just a residence, Kevin, you know, make people more disinclined, for instance, to welcome more density? Or changes to their zoning codes that would maybe allow for different and more diverse types of homes?
I definitely think it's a factor. You know, I mean, the term NIMBY comes up, not in my backyard. And I think that largely is driven by this impulse, you know, that we've reinforced as a society for the better part of 80 years, that the home is an asset. It's the primary asset for families. And when you frame it in that lens, instead of really framing it as the focal point of housing, residence, opportunity, it changes the way people think about it. They start trying to think about how to use it for economic gain and benefit and not trying to think of how their actions may be detrimental to the community as a whole. You know, the old, you know, short-term benefit for long-term, you know, pain. And I think that's definitely a big facet of what we've seen here. And although I think that what's really driving our current crisis is not even that impulse, I think that's definitely one of the things helping. I really think that it's the driving institutional investors who came in and have displaced those people who used to have to wrestle with that decision that have really made a bigger impact on the problem we're looking at today.
I want to talk a little bit about heirs property, which is something that we've spoken on this program about before. And generally, that's a situation where people are inheriting a home, but they don't have clear title. And so it kind of gets caught up in this mess and sometimes they lose the home. And so that's an issue, and there's a lot of effort now to help people resolve heirs property, get clear title. But there are pitfalls to even that. Explain what can happen when someone is able to make that transaction happen and maybe surprised on the back end.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the work, and you know, our organization is one that's doing it in trying to help resolve heirs title ownership issues is laudable, right? It's trying to effectively ensure equity remains in largely marginalized communities for the first time in generations. But there's two big problems that come up very quickly after we've completed that work. The first is, like in home sales, when the title is finally transferred to the heirs and recognized by a probate court order or otherwise, the property appraiser gets to reappraise the property for the first time, maybe the first time in 80 years. And in doing so, the property's taxes are going to increase dramatically. We've seen examples where a property was being assessed at a rate of roughly $30,000, and then the next year assessed at $210,000.
Wow.
And, you know, for anyone who knows your basic millage rates and kind of does the math in your head, that's an increase of roughly, you know, from $400 in taxes to roughly $2,100. And for low-income families, that can be just a backbreaker. It can ensure that that home is going to see a tax certificate issued the next year and get sold at a tax sale 2 years thereafter. So there's a lot of dangers. And so one of the biggest things we've been trying to caution people on is be prepared for what that tax increase is going to look like. The other part of it is a lot of these homes are hard to insure. And so once they get ownership, then becomes the kind of harder task of, all right, now you can get, you can use the equity, but you have to find ways to preserve it. And getting insured and insured at affordable rates is incredibly difficult.
So just briefly, there is an event coming up that is a fundraiser for Three Rivers. Tell us how people can participate.
Sure. So Thursday night at the Garden Club of Jacksonville, we have our first ever Jacksonville fundraiser. Our organization is headquartered in Gainesville, but we are seeing more and more cases coming out of Jacksonville. So we wanted to focus an event here, and it'll be at 6 o'clock. We've got Mission Barbecue is catering. We've got an open bar, and Firewater Tent Revival is performing live. It's going to be a really good time. We've got, Dan Hicken from the news is going to be there to MC a live auction as well. And then we are going to, it's going to be $50 for a person to come on in and participate. Sorry, Anne, I know you've got a little tickle.
Thank you guys so much for being on. We appreciate it. Yeah. Good luck with the fundraiser Thursday.
Thank you so much.
All right, we'll be right back. Welcome back. In addition to her own garden, our next guest works to cultivate inclusive horticultural spaces. Here to tell us about her mission and the relaunch of her podcast, Black in the Garden, is Kola B. Talkin. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're a podcaster. You're going to have to pick up where my voice is cracking out.
I got
here.
You. Yes.
You're from gardening. You're from Jacksonville. And I want to know how you kind of got into gardening.
Sure. So me getting into gardening, I actually got into gardening living in Jacksonville. I am one who was raised in Jacksonville, but not born in Jacksonville.
Okay.
And so, you know, went to elementary, middle school, all the way up until UNF here, and then went to be a trucker and back and forth to Jacksonville. So my origins kind of revolve around that. But at one point, coming back to Jacksonville as an adult, I'm staying on the north side and I'm just trying to figure out some things in life. And I got into plants because I figured after taking a very natural journey with like having my hair be natural, having a natural childbirth and a home birth, actually, I was trying to find ways to live as naturally as possible. And gardening really aligned with that because I was trying to determine how can I get the most hyper-local food for myself and my family to keep, you know, the chemicals out and things like that. And it did lead me to trying to figure out how to grow my own food, which I would say was a flop in my first attempt. Because one of the things about gardening is the misconception for those who think that you have to be perfect at it when you first get started is I tell people all the time, no, you have to kill a few plants to figure it out. You know, fortunately, that's not the same with like the medical profession.
Right.
Where you get a few cadavers before you get success. But that was my journey. It was starting with wanting to grow my own food and getting my confidence shaken because I tried to do it intuitively.
Mm-hmm.
And I just figured seed, water, sun, I got this, but not so much. So I got into houseplants and succulents and just trying to figure out other things about plants. And then a bug, it's like I kind of got a bug and I was obsessed with houseplants for quite some time. And this was around, I would say, 2016. I didn't really document my entry into gardening because I did not realize it was going to change my life in the way that it did.
So black gardening on social media, there has been kind of getting more attention.
Oh, yes.
Explain to me why that is.
Well, I advocate for it. And I'm not saying that it's booming because of me entirely. But what I can say that I know to be true is that there is an ancestral memory that's being activated. There's a return to the land. There's a return to having more of an interest in nature. There is land that is being passed from generation to generation. And there are people who are, you know, black people who are trying to figure out what to do with that land, how to activate that land. We're looking for refuge in going off grid and homesteading. We are having similar stories to what I just described in wanting to live a more natural way of life. And also we're just looking for methods that allow us to have some therapeutic reprieve from the stresses that are inherent to being black in America or in the world. And I know houseplants have been a very big source of, you know, therapy for black people as far as I'm aware, because I get a lot of interactions and engagements and conversations with black people who share their stories with me. And my story is kind of reflective in some points to many people who I've had conversations with.
So there's some tension sometimes for people in experiencing gardening, particularly in communities of color.
Yes.
African-Americans. Talk about facing that, processing it, how your podcast addresses that issue.
Okay. So run that back for me. I want to make sure I answer that question very well for you. So start from the top.
So historically, there has been exploitation of black people,
yes.
You know, enslaved people and working the land. And
yes.
So there is sometimes, I think, you know, a reckoning that has to happen for people to embrace that agricultural, you know, side.
I see what you mean. Okay. Thank you for reiterating that for me. So I call slavery involuntary gardening. And that obviously was forced upon black people at that time. And so generationally, in consideration of what we were going to do as far as what our source of livelihood, income, or work would be, we strayed away from that because of the trauma that was associated with it. You know, like that labor was, it was literally backbreaking and just unrelenting. And so having those kind of connections took us a few generations out of it. Not every single family, obviously, but many families, you know, that was an effect that was very real. But there are plenty of black people who never left it. And so my platform definitely aims to emphasize those stories to make sure that people know that, like, sure, there have been people who went away, black people who have went away from agriculture and any manner of a horticultural kind of interest or agricultural interest, but there are plenty who never went away from that. There are black farmers in, you know, mainly rural areas, but they are there and they are thriving, and those stories need to be told and heard. So it's job security for me.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're talking to the creator of the Black in the Garden podcast, focuses on the intersection of race and horticulture. And we welcome your questions or comments. You can reach us on air at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or reach out on social media. You dig into so many stories on your podcast. You have done stories about the secret gardens, the history of secret gardens that were planted by Black people during times of enslavement. Also witness trees, which I think is just a fascinating topic. Tell us a little bit about what witness trees are.
Witness trees. Actually, that was a talk that I gave for the, It was for an arboretum. It was for the Morton Arboretum. I was about to say Arnold. Shout out to Arnold, but it was for Morton Arboretum. I had to think about the salt. I did a webinar where we were discussing witness trees and Black people's connection to trees. I think about concepts, but in my platform, being Black in the Garden and celebrating Black people's connection with plants and nature, I think about it through the botanical lens as far as how it is connected with Blackness. And so in discussing witness trees, what a witness tree is a tree that is an old tree, generally, that has witnessed a historic event. And so I know the term witness sounds a little bit dramatic, but it's true. These trees were around, and people are not thinking about trees when they're doing all manner of things, but the trees have witnessed things like war. They have witnessed basically anything that has happened in the environment where that tree was in view of that event. That makes it a witness tree.
Mm-hmm. And why is that an important symbol or, you know, thing to recognize?
It's important. The context that I was coming from when I was considering putting that webinar together, one of the first things that I thought about was lynchings, unfortunately, because, you know, I hate to go dark. I hate to be morbid. It's early in the morning. But what I thought about was how that connection to trees and trees, those witness trees being the witnesses to those types of heinous acts. I was thinking about how these are things that we need to put into the forefront so that we have a better understanding of why Black people have a lot of different triggers when it comes to different elements of nature that we may not feel connected with. And so by putting it out there and just being very explicit about what some of those issues are and what some of those triggers can be, is a good way for us to get past that.
So your podcast is relaunching. One thing that I think is really interesting is you refer to your listeners as soil cousins.
Yes.
Tell us about that relationship you have with them.
So they're soil cousins. That terminology is important to me because I am very big on inclusivity. And I would come in at the beginning of the podcast in the first few years and months of me doing it, or the first few months, and I would say, hey, everybody, hey, guys, gals, and, you know, however else you identify. But I hated that. I don't like for anybody to feel othered. So I said, what is the unit? Soil cousins. The soil is what connects us. And so that connection is very important to me because I started from literal scratch, ground zero, had no listeners. Nobody knew who I was. I'm nobody's industry plant by any means. That is a funny double entendre, possibly.
Yeah, right.
So we'll do something with that later. But my soil cousins are my supporters. Anybody who is aware of what is happening with Black in the Garden, with the platform, and who is supporting it, they are my soil cousins.
Well, Cola B. Talkins, congrats on the podcast relaunch. Thanks for being here. Thanks for what you do. It's really a fascinating lesson.
I appreciate that. And thank you for having me. I always, if we're concluding, mm-hmm. I always conclude with love, light, and soil.
Oh, very nice. All right. Thanks, Cola. Stick around. We'll be back in just a minute with a robotic dog teaching students new tricks.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
Classical 24 brings listeners beautiful music from around the world, featuring the best of classical music from the all-time greats to the newest composers and performances. Download the WJCT app or visit wjct.org/jacksmusic to start listening today.
On the next Fresh Air, Emmy and Oscar-nominated comic, actor, and screenwriter Kristen Wiig. She was a beloved cast member on Saturday Night Live and starred in and co-wrote the film Bridesmaids. In her new TV series, Palm Royale, Wig plays a pageant queen trying to break into high society in the 1960s. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Our online feeds and searches are already full of it. AI-generated sludge that's polluting culture, discourse, and even the quality of information that helps shape developing brains.
It looks a lot like the beginnings of some sort of pollution of human culture itself and its replacement with synthetic content.
A neuroscientist on why the ubiquity of generative AI junk threatens our very humanness. That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11 on WJCT News 89.9.
What's for dinner? How about some insects?
I think I prefer the crickets. Even though the crickets are more bug-looking than the ants. The ants you could like be like, oh, maybe these are little beans.
Insects are being seen as the future of sustainable protein. They're already part of cuisines around the world. What will it take to make them a part of ours? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. A new breed of dog is being unleashed into the classrooms to inspire future scientists and engineers. And it's actually here in studio with us today. You might hear it humming in the background. But to tell us about it, I'm joined by Hamza Shanbari, Director of Innovation and Strategic Initiatives at DisruptTech, a division of Haskell. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having us.
Also joined by educator, composer, and chemist Jeremy Nix, also known as the Valence King. Welcome, Jeremy. Welcome back.
Yes, thank you. Glad to be here.
And to my left here, and you'd be able to see it if you're watching us on Facebook or YouTube right now, it's a robot dog called Bolt, and it is extraordinary. Let's just start by, what is this used for, Hamza? What is its purpose?
Right. So first and foremost, Haskell is a design build company, and we try to help our clients deliver the best product possible. So what Bolt can help us with is that quality assurance of construction projects. So we would send him into the project, and you can see how he has tons of sensors on him. He has a LiDAR scanner, a GoPro camera, and a 360 camera, and collects all that data semi-autonomously now, but coming up with fully autonomous soon. We would take all that data and in the back end kind of process it to see, are we on schedule? Are we on track? Are we installing things correctly in the right place? Kind of like our quality assurance metric, so to say.
And you've used it, I saw, to surveil places, for instance, to make sure that, you know, all is clear inside EverBank Stadium.
Yes, that was one of our big use cases for EverBank Stadium, because, you know, they were looking at renovation, but the records that they had were dated. So they wanted like a more updated as-built drawings and model, 3D model. So we used Bolt and collaboration with the drone and the VDC world where they got the laser scanners, and we put all that together.
So Jeremy, how does this translate into like a classroom curriculum? I mean, you've kind of developed a STEAM curriculum around Bolt.
Right.
How do you do it? And I mean, you're a musician, right?
Yeah. So, so actually, you know, it's been kind of a lifetime expedition to get to this point. I'm a classically trained pianist, a composer, a musician. But also, I was a research scientist doing protein biochemistry at Mayo Clinic for a decade, and mostly in Alzheimer's research. And so when my creative and business partners, H. Johnson and I, began to craft our multi-tiered agency, which really encompasses a plethora of projects across the spectrum of professional endeavors, it made sense to synthesize these different disciplines and create this program. And so one of the driving goals is to help students understand that you can look at a different phenomenon from different perspectives, right? Like, so you can look at a planet and you can take the sound of the electromagnetic radiation of that planet and you can listen to it as a sound, and you can also compose music. And so we try to encourage students to have this kind of foundational framework for everything they approach in life. So we want to expose them to as many different technologies and creative modalities as possible.
So how does the dog come into it?
Yeah, so the dog itself, right, is it's utilizing, for instance, laser technology. Laser is a form of electromagnetic radiation. It's a wave, it's a vibration. So we can also listen to that as a sound. We can think of that as a sound. So we draw inspiration from the technical, from the world, and both, and also from our inner realities.
But he's also fun.
He is fun. Yeah. So can you give us a demonstration of some kind? Can you make Bolt move a little bit here in studio? And
yeah. So this is his kind of just walking around. And we have a little dance, if you don't mind.
Yeah, let's.
he has lights, so if he goes into like dark areas and stuff like that, we can see through that. And last but not least, he is a dog that can bark too.
That's terrific. I'm not gonna lie, it's a little creepy. Do kids get freaked out when they encounter?
Actually, him? Not. Like, we've took him to a couple of like schools in like, the Duval County. They have the STEM program that come to the Jumbo Shrimp Stadium, and they get super excited.
Yeah,
they see it. One of the things that really kind of threw me off is like, the younger the kids, the more they act like he's a real dog. Like, they try to pet him and talk to him and stuff. I'm like, do you not understand?
They don't have that preconceived cynicism from watching all these like horror technological movies.
So how fun is it for you to present this to class? Do you come in kind of like how you came into the studio, marching in and introducing Bolt?
Always the entrance is the fun part.
Yeah,
I love seeing the reaction. So we actually, when we stood him up in the stadium, it was like behind a wall, but you can see the kids walking in, and there was like hundreds of them. And the first time they see it, it's like, wow, that's the exciting part.
So you actually have an event today, right?
Yes.
So today is actually the last day of class at the program. And so Hamza is, you know, they agreed to sponsor having Bolt come to the classroom. We're really grateful for that. This is just one in a number of different collaborations that we've had with Haskell. We actually were in here earlier the year for a community drive that they were a flagship sponsor of. And we have some other things in development. But Bolt's coming into the classroom today to see the students, for the students to get to, you know, hear about the technology, the engineering involved, and hopefully, you know, get to explore and learn more about it. And also, I have to give a huge shout out to Brad and Nancy Hatton, who are the proprietors at Montessori Tides, for being, you know, our biggest number one supporters and believers and allowing us to do really cool things like this with the students.
It's so cool. And thank you so much for bringing Bolt in and for the demonstration. It's just amazing.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, Hamzan Shanbari, Jeremy Nix, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, and that's our program. You can join us tomorrow when we talk to local street skate champion and Olympic hopeful Pope Hinson about a skateboarding career that began at age 2. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.